You can watch and hear Mark and Molly Hemingway, Matt Walsh, Chris Roseborough, Greg Kokel, Hans Feeney, and Katie Faust at the 2020 Virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. Making the Case is Friday, July 24th and Saturday, July 25th. The $135 registration fee includes both live and on-demand viewing. For more information and to register, visit issuesetc.org or give us a call, 618-223-8385. It's really kind of living at a particularly remarkable time in history. I'm not talking about the pandemic or about no baseball or even the political upheaval. I'm talking about the Supreme Court handing down several very significant victories for religious liberty, all in rapid-fire succession. And that is encouraging. But is it enough, especially given the fact that the LGBTQ agenda, the sexual revolution, has already standardized much of its propaganda in the institutions of our country? What about people who don't have a religious objection to, say, calling a man a woman or a woman a man? They just want to deal with reality. Well, they can't take a religious exception. What do we do about them? Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're going to talk about LGBTQ rights and religious liberty. Dr. Ryan Anderson joins us, Senior Research Fellow in American Principles and Public Policy at the Heritage Foundation. He's the John Paul II Teaching Fellow in Social Thought at the University of Dallas, author and editor of The Public Discourse, author of several books, including Truth Overruled, The Future of Marriage and Religious Freedom, and When Harry Became Sally, Responding to the Transgender Moment. He's also written a column titled Religious Liberty is Important, but It's Not Enough. Dr. Anderson, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks for having me.
You say that even the best religious liberty wins in the Supreme Court can't adequately contend in a proxy war over substantive issues. What do you mean by that?
Sure. So right now, for the past at least 10, 15, 20, if not 50 years, Americans have been having a disagreement about the nature of human sexuality. That's why so many of our most contentious religious liberty debates are about the HHS contraception mandate or abortion regulations or about gay marriage or transgender, this, that, and the other thing. And it's not an effective strategy to fight a rearguard action about religious liberty rather than contending with the truth of the matter about underlying issues of human sexuality, the substantive issues. Some people say, well, look, we've already lost all those substantive debates, and so that's why they don't want to engage on the issue. I think that's misguided for two reasons. One is that we haven't lost on those things. I mean, if anything, we're making progress on the abortion issue. Obergefell was decided 5 years ago, and it's premature to suggest that because the Supreme Court says something on gay marriage that we can never reconsider. And on the transgender issue, we haven't even fought the issue, let alone have we lost on the issue, and that we're now finding that many people who aren't religious have many of the same concerns about adequate health care for gender dysphoria, concerns about privacy and safety when it comes to bathrooms and locker rooms and homeless shelters, concerns about equality and fairness when it comes to athletics, with, you know, girls losing track competitions to boys who identify as girls. And so to describe all of those concerns as, well, we have religious liberty, or, you know, the Supreme Court will eventually protect religious liberty, it simply removes us from the actual kind of terrain of the discussion, right? We're having a discussion about these substantive issues. We need to engage on those terms.
So crystallize it for us, if you would. What is the central truth or truths that we need to be defending?
To my mind, it's all right there in the first couple of sentences, first couple of pages of the book of Genesis, but that we can defend this both theologically and philosophically. But the central truths, to my mind, are that we're made in the image and likeness of God, that we're created male and female, and that male and female are created for each other. And the various things that I mentioned, whether it be abortion, which denies that we're made in the image and likeness of God, whether it be gay marriage that denies that male and female are created for each other, whether it be transgender issues that denies that we're created male and female, right? those are the hot button issues right now in our culture, that we're made in the image and likeness of God and therefore have profound and intrinsic dignity and worth, that we're created male and female, and that male and female are created for each other. And those are the truths that we need to be defending, not merely our religious liberty not to violate those truths. That's important. But these are public truths. These are creational ordinances. These are part of the natural law. And therefore, any human law, any man-made law that violates them is going to be an unjust law. There are going to be consequences, not just for religious liberty, but there are going to be consequences for the common good of the political community. Consequences when you get abortion law wrong. Consequences when you get marriage law wrong. Consequences when you get gender identity law wrong. And so we need to be engaged just as much as those issues as we are on the religious liberty side of things.
Talk about three recent Supreme Court victories with respect to religious liberty. Let's begin with Espinosa. What was the case and why do you say it was good but insufficient?
Sure. So Espinosa, it's a great win because it struck down notoriously anti-Catholic Blaine amendments as applied to government funding for education. And the likely consequences of this logic is that it's going to extend beyond government funding of education to government funding, period. What Blaine Amendment said was that you couldn't use any government funds for so-called sectarian institutions. So you could, in this case, there was a state that had a scholarship program that would go to students, and students could use these scholarships at any private school except for religious private schools. And so the Supreme Court said, look, that's unconstitutional. You don't have to have a scholarship program for private schools, but if you create one, you can't discriminate against religious private schools. I think this is good, but it's obviously not good enough because the vast majority of students don't attend private schools at all. They attend the government-run schools that we call public schools. And if those public schools are indoctrinating students in a bad gender ideology, if they're kind of corrupting the minds of students with all sorts of left-wing propaganda, then religious liberty isn't enough. It's important, but it's not enough. We need to contend for what's being taught at public schools, right? What's going on at the government-run institutions, because we should be concerned not just for the education and the well-being of our children, but the education and the well-being of all children. Maybe we do, you know, we're fortunate that we can afford to send our kids to private school, or maybe we applied for one of these vouchers and we got the scholarship to attend the private school. What about the families that aren't wealthy enough to attend private schools? What about the families that didn't get the voucher to attend the private school? What about the states that don't even have school choice programs, right? We should be just as concerned about what's going on at those public schools as we are about religious liberty protection for our own institutions.
What was the issue around the very long-standing Supreme Court case, Little Sisters of the Poor, and why, while being good, was it still insufficient?
Yeah, so I mean, this, your listeners, this will not be the first time that they've heard about the Little Sisters of the Poor, nor most likely will it be the last time. And the reason I say that is Joe Biden has already promised that if he's elected president, he's going to roll back the protections for the Little Sisters to where they stood before the Hobby Lobby case. So let me back up and explain for listeners what this is all about. The Little Sisters of the Poor case, the Hobby Lobby case, all involve the HHS mandate. The HHS mandate was created by the Department of Health and Human Services, the HHS part of the mandate, as their implementation of Obamacare. Obamacare said the Secretary of HHS shall mandate certain drugs and devices as the Secretary determines. The Secretary determined that there were 20 contraceptive devices that every healthcare plan had to cover cost-free, and four of those contraceptive devices carry an FDA label saying that they can cause an early abortion. So this is literally an early abortion mandate. That's why Hobby Lobby objected. They're evangelicals, so they object to the abortion aspect of this. The Little Sisters of the Poor are Catholics, so they object both to the contraception part and to the abortion part. What the Supreme Court said last week was that the Trump administration did have authority to protect the Little Sisters of the Poor, to provide them with a religious liberty exemption. Why do I say this isn't good enough? Let me give you two reasons. One is that we still have a government mandate mandating cost-free coverage of contraception and abortion, right? And that's just an unjust mandate. Two, Vice President Biden has already told us that if one day he becomes President Biden, he's going to take away these religious liberty protections. And so it really is insufficient to say you can spend 7 years in court, as the Little Sisters of the Poor have already spent. They've already spent 7 years in court. And, you know, if you are victorious, that's good enough, because the process is part of the punishment here, right? Talk to Jack Phillips. The process of going through court, going all the way up to the Supreme Court, even if you win, it's still part of the punishment. And even here, the Little Sisters of the Poor have now gone to the Supreme Court three different times. They've won all three times, and yet it's still not over. That's what I mean when I say religious liberty isn't enough, because the underlying mandate still exists. And so long as that underlying mandate still exists, their freedom is still going to be in jeopardy. And for the rest of America, we're still going to have an unjust mandate on the books.
Dr. Ryan Anderson is our guest. We're talking about LGBTQ rights and religious liberty. He's Senior Research Fellow in American Principles and Public Policy at the Heritage Foundation. We'll talk about another case, Our Lady of Guadalupe, and why it's good but insufficient next.
Protecting the most vulnerable, especially children, is a critical principle throughout Scripture. And the main vehicle that God has instituted to protect children is marriage.
Katie Faust talking about her presentation at this year's virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
Adults, especially Christian adults, should never ask a child to sacrifice their fundamental right to be known and loved by both their mother and father just so an adult can have something that they want. That means adults need to do hard things in their own lives, and that also means that adults, especially Christians, need to fight for child-centric public policy as well.
You can watch Katie Faust's presentation, Making the Case for Children's Rights, at the 2020 Virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, July 24th, and Saturday, July 25th. Conference registrants can watch live and on demand. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org.
Providing artillery support for the church militant on the front lines, you're listening to Issues Etc.
For your next family vacation, consider Our Beach House, a charming three-bedroom vacation rental on beautiful Siesta Key. Just off Sarasota, Florida, Siesta Key Beach, consistently voted America's best, is just 100 steps away. Whether you're watching the sunset over the Gulf of Mexico or frolicking in the warm surf, you and your family will fall in love with Siesta Key. Check us out at SiestaKeyRentalGenie.com or call Virginia at 941-266-1858.
Remember when education was about the fundamental skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic? And about reading great literature and studying history to give our kids a model for what it is to be a good person? Memoria Press's Classical Christian Curriculum offers that very model for your homeschool. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR20. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about LGBTQ rights and religious liberty. Dr. Ryan Anderson is our guest. The 2020 virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case conference begins in 10 days. You can watch some of your favorite guests lead presentations on woke ideology, informed Christian citizens, children's rights, discussing Christian convictions, the Trinity, and the obedience of Christ. The $135 registration fee includes both live and on-demand viewing. Making the Case is Friday, July 24th and Saturday, July 25th. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org or by calling 618-223-8385, the 2020 virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case conference. Ryan, another case. Tell us about the case involving Our Lady of Guadalupe and why it also was not sufficient.
So Our Lady of Guadalupe was a case involving teachers at Catholic schools, and what the Supreme Court there said was that a Supreme Court doctrine known as the ministerial exception applies to any teacher who functions in a ministerial capacity where ministerial capacity is determined by the school itself. So it's not just kind of like ordained clergy, but anyone who is instructing students in how to both understand and live out the faith. So this case was fairly easy because these particular teachers would lead students in prayer. They would take students to the chapel for worship services. So it was pretty clear they function in a ministerial capacity. I personally think the logic of the opinion and just the truth of the matter is that every teacher at a religious school should be functioning in a ministerial capacity, because every teacher should be embodying what it means to live out the Christian virtues. So if you're the geometry teacher, whether you're like the French teacher, whether you're the football coach, whether you're the choir director, you can show how to do all of those things in a Christian way. So how to experience the joy of victory and kind of like the misery of defeat on the football field as a Christian, right? How to sing as a Christian, right? All these activities, they're embodying the faith, right? How to live it out, not just instructing verbally. I think, especially for children, they learn more about the faith through it being embodied, through it being taught to them by emulation, by example, than they do kind of by like chalkboard teaching, right? We need both. So the case is good because it allows religious schools to decide for themselves who's going to be teaching on behalf of the school. Why is it not enough? Because some people were saying that this was a good response to the Supreme Court's Bostock decision. This was the decision of the Supreme Court that said sexual orientation and gender identity were somehow like baked into the phrase sex. And so our civil rights laws that say no discrimination on the basis of sex also mean no discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. So this isn't enough, because while it might apply to all teachers at faith-based schools, it does nothing for other religious employees, and it does nothing for all of the non-religious institutions that also have concerns with gender ideology. So the idea that, you know, Justice Gorsuch could read gender ideology into the Civil Rights Act, and then certain people will be like, oh, but we have religious liberty through the ministerial exemption, and that's good enough. It's not good enough, because female athletes at public schools are going to have questions about what transgender protections mean under Title IX. Secular doctors who don't think transitioning is good medical procedures are going to have questions about what gender ideology now means through the civil rights laws in our healthcare laws, right? There's a whole variety of non-religious institutions and individuals and values that are still going to be threatened, and so religious liberty won't be enough.
Go into a little more detail about that case you mentioned, Bostock. How does it color the picture?
Sure. So Bostock was specifically about Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. And so for listeners who aren't familiar, Title VII deals with employment law, and it says you can't discriminate on the basis of sex. This is a 1964 law, and what Congress meant then was that you can't treat men and women differently in the employment context, right? So you can't say men can be lawyers, but women can only be paralegals, something like that. What took place in the case that dealt with gender identity was there was a Christian owner of a funeral home. He had a funeral director working for him who for 8 years identified as a man because he is a man. He showed up for work every day wearing a coat and a tie and a suit. And then he gave the owner a letter saying, 2 weeks from now, I'm going to be coming back wearing a dress, identifying as a woman. And the employee said, this isn't going to work out. I can't have a middle-aged man presenting as a woman wearing a dress, interacting with grieving families who are burying their recently deceased loved ones. There wasn't going to be any of the surgery, any of the hormones. It was literally a two-week vacation, and then I'm coming back as a woman. The Supreme Court said that's discrimination on the basis of sex. But many of us are concerned that this won't just be limited to the employment context, because this was a theory of discrimination, that if you discriminate against someone based upon their gender identity, you just are discriminating against them based on their sex. So we have other laws that say no discrimination on the basis of sex. We have healthcare laws that say no discrimination on the basis of sex. What Congress meant was you can't treat men and women differently for healthcare. What the activists now say is that if you perform a double mastectomy for a woman with breast cancer, but you won't perform the double mastectomy for the woman who wants to identify as a man, you're discriminating based on gender identity. We have laws that say no discrimination basis of sex in education. It's Title IX of the Education Amendments. What this meant was you can't treat boys and girls unequally for education. But what we're now seeing is some activists are saying this means you have to allow the boy who identified as a girl into the girls' locker room, and he gets to compete against the girls in track competitions, et cetera, et cetera. And that's where you've seen the headlines, particularly out of Connecticut, of high school girls losing championships to high school boys who identified as girls. That's what I mean when I say that Bostock is going to be applied to these other situations, and that religious liberty won't be enough to defend the substantive issues, equality with respect to athletics, privacy and safety with respect to single-sex facilities, good medicine with respect to people who suffer from gender dysphoria.
Do you think that Gorsuch himself and his reasoning there, do you think he anticipated what will be kind of the inevitable broader application of his logic in Bostock?
I don't know. There's a section of his majority opinion where he's replying to Justice Alito's dissenting opinion, and Justice Alito points all of this out. And he's like, the Supreme Court is just opening up a giant can of worms when we make law. That's what legislatures are supposed to do. And we're just making stuff up, and we're not answering these questions. And Gorsuch's response is, yes, undoubtedly all these cases will come, but none of them are before us today. And when those cases come, you know, we'll take them up and we'll answer them. And so I don't see how he couldn't have seen that all these things are now live questions, and how unsettling that is for the rule of law. One of the things that a kind of healthy society has is a stable rule of law, so you know what the law is so that you can follow the law. Gorsuch has thrown a lot of this into question, and I don't see how he could say that he didn't know that that's what he was doing.
How and where can we take concrete steps to defend the objective truth of the sexual binary, male and female, in law and regulation?
Sure. I mean, I think the first thing is just knowing the arguments about the truth of the matter. That's why shows like yours, Issues, Etc., are so important, because you're equipping people to make the arguments. Right? This isn't necessarily just going to be one in law and policy and court, but it's going to be one at the water cooler, at the kind of like, you know, the Little League game where the parents are talking. Like, equipping listeners to be able to make those arguments is important. But then there's also going to be a legislative component. I think Congress right now could say, okay, the Supreme Court has ruled, but we place a check and a balance on the court in our system of government with separation of powers, checks and balances. And so we're going to say that no institution can be forced into allowing biological males into female-only spaces. No institution can be forced into allowing males to compete against female in female-only athletic competitions, that no institution can be forced to do sex reassignment procedures when the doctors, physicians, hospitals, healthcare plans judge them to be bad medicine. I think there is a legislative component here, and you'll notice that nothing that I just said mentioned religious liberty. Right? It was that no institution, vis-a-vis athletics, vis-a-vis housing, vis-a-vis bathrooms, vis-a-vis medicine, not just a religious liberty carve-out. That's how I think we should be thinking about the legislative response here.
Dr. Ryan Anderson is Senior Research Fellow in American Principles and Public Policy at the Heritage Foundation. He's the John Paul II Teaching Fellow in Social Thought at the University of Dallas, founder and editor of The Public Discourse, author of several books, including Truth Overruled, The Future of Marriage and Religious Freedom, and When Harry Became Sally, Responding to the Transgender Moment. He's also written a recent column titled Religious Liberty is Important, but It's Not Enough. You can read it and purchase Ryan's books at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk On Demand Archives. Ryan, thank you.
Thank you.
In Hour 2 of Issues, Etc., we'll be looking at the parable of the weeds in Matthew chapter 13, a peculiar little story that Jesus tells in Matthew's version with no explanation whatsoever about a man who planted good seed, and then an enemy comes along and plants bad seed, but he doesn't want the weeds pulled. Dr. Carl Ficantra of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana will be with us. I'm Todd Wilkin. Stay with us.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. our mailing address, issues, etc. P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues, etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.